You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW-Green Bay is the newest member of the Bee City USA Club. We'll talk with a professor there about the state's honeybee population, how it's doing, and how the school is creating pollinator habitats. Now, the trial of the former Minneapolis police officer and last year's death of George Floyd is winding down. After 3 weeks of testimony and expert opinions, the prosecution and defense made their closing arguments today. Now the fate of former officer Derek Chauvin is in the hands of the jury. He's charged with second and third degree murder and second degree manslaughter. The incident sparked protests and violence in Minneapolis and other cities across the country last summer. Tensions in the Twin Cities have been heightened, not just because of the Chauvin case, but last week's shooting death of a black man by police in the nearby suburb of Brooklyn Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the latest and where things stand in the Derek Chauvin trial? Have you been following it yourself? What do you feel about the arguments from the prosecution and defense? Is there an outcome you're hoping for? How would you describe your general feelings toward police if you're an officer or a retired officer? What's going through your mind? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Osler is the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Before we visit the trial, Mark, can you give us a sense of what things are like in the Twin Cities right now as the jury meets, as people are watching for this verdict in the future?
Yeah, it is a very different atmosphere, quite tense. That yesterday I was in the Uptown neighborhood, and there was one corner where on each, each corner there was a armored personnel carrier and National Guardsmen standing in front of stores. And of course, that's unusual at any time. So it's definitely ratcheted up the anxiety in this area.
What were some of the key moments in the Chauvin trial so far as you've been following it?
Well, we're pretty much done. We just finished up the closing arguments. But, you know, looking at the most important witnesses, in closing, the government relied a lot on Charles McMillan, a man who came and testified, said he witnessed the killing, that he had an exchange with Officer Chauvin. They also talked a lot about a 9-year-old girl who wasn't named during the trial for privacy reasons, for the conclusion that even a 9-year-old knew that this was wrong as she watched it happening. And so in retrospect, looking at what the government relied in their closing, those two were both very important, as was, of course, the expert testimony of Dr. Martin Tobin, who was, by many accounts, one of the best expert witnesses many of us have ever seen. He was credible. He was consistent. He seemed very authoritative. And so that was crucial. And then the defense did not call many witnesses, and they only had two experts, and their medical expert did not seem to be a match for Dr. Tobin. So we got to closings, and today what surprised a lot of people was the length of the closings. Typically, these will be an hour, at most an hour and a half. The government went for an hour and 45 minutes, and the defense, I believe, went almost 3 hours in their closing. So they took up a lot more time. Something very unusual happened today, which is that the judge interrupted the closing argument of the defense because it was 2:10 and the jury hadn't had lunch yet. And so he let them go, get their lunch, and then returned to the closing after that.
We're looking at the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis with Mark Osler from the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, law professor there. You can join in with your questions and thoughts at 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to a little bit of each of the closing arguments. First of all, prosecutors described Chauvin as a killer who knew what he was doing to George Floyd. Here's attorney Steve Schleicher talking to the jury.
And what the defendant did here was a straight up felony assault. This was not policing. It was unnecessary. It was gratuitous. It was disproportionate. And he did it on purpose. No question. This was not an accident. He did not trip and fall and find himself upon George Floyd's knee and neck. He did what he did on purpose. And it killed George Floyd.
A couple of things there, Mark. First of all, saying this was a deliberate act. Also that phrase, this was not policing. And the prosecution seemed to be careful today to say police are not on trial here today. Derek Chauvin is. Can you talk about those aspects of the closing?
Yeah, and just on the second one first about policing, that's something that they emphasized throughout the trial. One of the unusual aspects of this trial was that we saw the blue wall of silence come down, that there were a number of police officers who testified against their fellow officer here. And certainly they were treated with great respect by both sides. And, you know, on intent, that's something that is an element of it's a little tricky because the felony murder, the intent has to be to commit an assault. So that argument that this wasn't accidental, this is something that he did and it went beyond policing. It wasn't something that was a legitimate use of force, but something that went beyond what would be a legitimate use of force was an argument they really had to make to counter the defense.
Now, here is Chauvin's attorney on the defense side, Eric Nelson, telling jurors that they didn't get a complete picture of events from the prosecution. Here's a listen.
Throughout the course of this trial, you've seen us do this, right? Little snippets. A second here, a second there, a screenshot here, a screenshot there. You need to review the entirety of the evidence in this case during the course of your deliberations as well. And I can tell you that some of the videos that we've seen, they're much longer than what was presented in court. There's additional information, and you're going to see some of that as we go through this case today.
So, Mark, what do you make of that effort to telling the jury, hey, look at the whole context, the whole story here from the defense?
It was something that worked pretty well for Mr. Nelson, that what he wanted to do was use that video to establish more context, that the government had really focused on the 9 minutes and 29 seconds in which ex-officer Chauvin had his knee on the neck of George Floyd. And the defense was trying to broaden the lens so that the context of what happened before that was before the jury as well. And some of the things that he did were interesting. For example, something that was raised by one of the witnesses was that while he had his knee on the neck, Officer Chauvin, he lifted his foot off the ground, which seemed that he was shifting all of his weight on top of the neck. And of course, that was presented as a still photograph. And what Eric Nelson did was go back and show that entire video clip to emphasize the brief moment of time in which the foot was actually off the ground. And so he was able to make some points there. And it was interesting because it was the inverse of what many of us expected, which is that video was going to be used mostly by the government. It turned out that probably the defense used video more in their closing than the government did.
You had tweeted earlier today, Mark, that as important as the closing arguments were, you saw something important in the judge's instructions to the jury for their deliberations when it came to the theories as to the cause of George Floyd's death. Can you talk about what the judge said to the jurors?
Yeah, what the judge said on causation. I mean, there's a couple of things that were really important there. And the most important one, and this is something that came up because I think this was being misconstrued or misrepresented by Eric Nelson in closing, is that the Derek Chauvin doesn't have to have been the only cause, that there could be other causes. It's just his actions only need to be a substantial cause. And a lot of the argument that we heard from the defense was that, they said there weren't any other causes. Not really what they were presenting, and certainly not what the legal standard is. What I was tweeting about before is that when the judge was instructing them on superseding causes, he said that if you're going to find a superseding cause actually was the cause of the death, that has to have only been the only cause, and standing on its own as a but-for cause of the death.
We're looking at the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. He's charged with second and third degree murder and second degree manslaughter in the death of George Floyd last year, Memorial Day. Mark Osler is with us, law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the trial? What stood out to you so far? Do you have thoughts on what you want to see the jury decide? Do you have questions for our guest about what you've seen there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the Derek Chauvin trial, the former police officer in Minneapolis charged in the death of George Floyd last year. Closing arguments began this morning, wrapped up this afternoon. Now the jury will decide whether Chauvin's innocent or guilty of the murder and manslaughter charges against him. Mark Osler stays with us, law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on what you've seen, if you've been following this trial, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Brad is with us in West Bend. Brad, hi.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Brad?
Well, I guess my comment is this. After all the testimonies of the superiors, you said none of this was trained. None of this, every single action he took was incorrect. To think that a jury of people, I get it, that it's a system. To think that, you know, someone who may be a baker, someone who may be a retail worker, someone might be able to take everything that was told to them, like, no, he was wrong, we're the superiors, but no, I'm still going to let him go. I'm still going to vote not guilty, even though I have no expertise. I have none of that because I'm a retail worker and such and such. I guess to me, when all your superiors come in and say, no, you were wrong, it shouldn't be much of a trial per se. It should just be, how much time are you looking at?
Brad, thanks a lot for the call. And that's the nature of jury trials, Mark. I guess we bring in everyday folks to evaluate these claims made by people, whether it's, as Brad is talking about, the police supervisors or the medical experts evaluating those claims and trying to figure out what to do with them.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that we need to realize is how unusual we are in relying on jury trials. I've been talking today to Al Jazeera, to a radio station in New Zealand, and one of the questions that I hear often from them is, why have a jury decide this? Why not have experts decide it? And we have good reasons for juries, that it does bring an understanding of the community to bear that's really important. Also, having 12 people compare notes means that someone caught everything probably one way or another, and it's done us well over time.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brad. But in this particular case, Mark, with, as Brad mentioned, those police supervisors, Chauvin's own superior officers testifying against them, how much weight, and again, I will not ask you to predict what a jury will do, but how much weight do you think testimony like that could carry?
I think it does matter. And, you know, that blue wall of silence that where police protect one another really came down in this case. And I was hearing from the pool reporter who was in the room at the time that, especially when Chief Arredondo was testifying, that the jurors were really plugged into that it did matter that you had these police officers saying this was wrong.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brad, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Laura with us in Manitowoc. Laura, hi.
Hi. I'm glad that you have a law professor on, because I would like for him to address this little bit of logic, or rather illogic, which is that we're referring to Officer Chauvin as former Officer Chauvin. And I don't know if that is a result of, you know, if that's a temporary thing, or I can't imagine that no matter what the outcome of this case is, that anyone expects that he's going to work again as a police officer. So in light of that, if the defense is making the argument, or if either side is making the argument that his behavior was within the line of duty of a police officer, that it was police officer conduct, it's almost like it's colored already. Like we're saying that what he did is certainly not police officer conduct, because he's been removed from his job. He's lost his title. He'll never work again. Isn't that sort of an indictment or a verdict right there?
Laura, thanks for the call. And correct me if I'm wrong, Mark. I believe Chauvin was fired, in effect, a day or so after Memorial Day last year.
It was the day after the incident. It was mm-hmm. Chief Arredondo who did that, and did it in a very public way, fired all four of them and said that this is not behavior that we're going to tolerate in our department. He was quite firm and quick in doing that.
And is this, thanks for the call, Laura, is this something, as Laura was saying there, that shows up in the trial, that maybe even the prosecution brought up, that the the fact that he was fired here suggests that the defense is wrong in arguing that he was working within the bounds of an on-duty officer.
Actually, I don't think that came into the evidence. I seem to remember that was a subject of a motion in limine, that they didn't want that coming in about him being fired and exactly when. Typically that kind of administrative measure won't come into the criminal trial. And at any rate, whatever it is that caused the chief to make that decision, that information was before the jury as well, and they can make their independent evaluation.
Thanks a lot for that call, Laura, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mark Osler, professor of law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, looking at the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Back to our callers now. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, my fear is that he's going to be acquitted and not found guilty of murder. And I just think that would be a really sad thing if this has happened too many times. Because all this does is give the police more power to continue to murder our citizens. And if we would convict a few of these officers, send them to prison, I would think from there on out, people would think twice before they murder one of our citizens. This has got to stop.
Cindy, thanks a lot for the call. And Mark, I think a lot of people, wherever they stand on hoping for an outcome of the trial, share with Cindy the idea that the trial could and maybe should send a message about policing to the wider public. In a courtroom, though, is that something people are talking about, or is that something they're really trying to steer clear of?
Well, it's in some states, it's allowable for the government in making their closing argument to say to the jurors, you should send a message to the community that we will not tolerate that. And, other states don't allow that send a message language. But it certainly is, it's a role of criminal law that we're drawing the lines. And I certainly agree with the caller that I think there should be a conviction here based on what I've seen. And I expect that there will be. And that will be hopefully an inflection point in our society where there's a new era of holding the police accountable when things like this happen.
Thanks a lot for that call, Cindy. I imagine if I were a defense attorney in a case like this, though, Mark, I would try to be convincing the jury that you are not trying on the basis of sending a message. You are supposed to be looking at the details of this particular case. Is that something we heard from the defense here?
Yeah, I think that Eric Nelson did try to keep their eye down on the ball and show reasonable doubt and that it was about the facts that were before them. But we didn't hear the government really making that send a message argument. So it didn't come in, and that's probably appropriate.
Let's go now to Paul with us in Eau Claire. Paul, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Paul?
Good. My comment is that I think it's going to be very hard to get 12 jurors to unanimously agree on anything, let alone that this police officer intentionally tried to kill this man. I think if this was a civil case, that's one thing. But as we all know, O.J. Simpson got off. And I just think it's going to be very hard to convince 12 jurors to agree all to the same thing.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. And especially, Mark, with the standard that the defense attorney was raising of beyond reasonable doubt here, do you see that Paul might be right, that it might be a challenge to get the jurors to agree on something?
Absolutely. It often is a challenge, and it only takes one juror to create a hung jury situation. But there's two things in play here that do mean that we could end up with a conviction, very likely we'll end up with a conviction. One is time, that they have all the time in the world to work on that holdout juror, at least until the judge calls a halt to it. And the other is the ability to compromise, that there's three counts here. And if there's someone who's for acquittal and the overwhelming majority of the jury is for second-degree murder, it's entirely possible that they'll compromise on third-degree murder or second-degree manslaughter, and that's the outcome that we'd see, so that they could get it done and go home from the perspective of some of those jurors.
Thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. We'll go to Holly with us in Sheboygan. Holly, hi.
Hi. I guess I'm on the fence about this situation. I understand and do believe that the police officer used the wrong procedures and did cause the death of George Floyd. But I see in many of these cases that are happening all over the United States, there's so much resistance, resisting arrest and it puts officers in a bind trying to hold a person down. And so they use the excuse of, I can't breathe, or this is something, or whatever. And the officer lets up, and then they take off on him, or just, the officer gets hurt.
Holly, thanks a lot for the call. We just have a minute or so left. Mark, that it, was that part of the defense argument that you know, the police face this uncertainty if someone might at some point be resisting arrest?
Yeah, and that the threat that that might pose. Look, in the end, let's imagine that they just let him go. They had his ID. They knew who he was. They would have been able to round, you know, come back to him about the $20 counterfeit. That the problem is that if people resist arrest or do resist, the response can't be to kill them.
Holly, thanks for the call. Mark, what do we know about a timeline? You said the jurors have, in some ways, as much time as they want. What are people expecting for deliberations at a timeline?
Well, most people I'm talking about expect it to be short or long. In other words, we'll get a verdict back by tomorrow, which would be short. Or if there's a holdout or a few holdouts, there will take a much longer period of time. We could be looking at a week.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Mark Osler is a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. We talked to him today about the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Closing arguments wrapped up this afternoon. Now the case is in the hands of the jury. As we heard, a verdict could come quickly or it could take a while. Coming up, we'll find out how UW Green Bay is being recognized for its work to create habitats for honeybees and other pollinators. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, paper products manufacturer Kimberly Clark said last week it would relocate more than 250 jobs from the Fox Valley to Illinois. We'll talk to a WPR reporter about what the announcement means for the company's tax deal with the state of Wisconsin. Now, the Bee City USA Club has a new member, UW Green Bay. It's joining the ranks as a campus affiliate. The designation is given to schools and cities that work to support bee population through pollinator habitats and other projects. Amy Wolf is a professor of natural and applied sciences at UW Green Bay and an expert on the state's native pollinators. She jump-started the idea of nominating the campus. Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. I'm really happy to be with you on the beginning of Earth Week.
And Amy, tell us about the projects you have going on at UW Green Bay aimed at helping our, especially I think, native bee populations here in the state.
Yeah, so we recently, as you mentioned, became a Bee Campus USA, and this is an initiative that is put out by the Xerces Society. And the Xerces Society is an international nonprofit organization focused on invertebrate conservation. So the aim really is to create this network of universities that partner as a community, which engages students and faculty and staff and administrators to work together on the common goal of native pollinator conservation. And we have just recently embarked on this. So we just recently have this designation. And as part of this partnership, institutions make certain commitments. So we have committed to creating and enhancing pollinator habitat by increasing the abundance of native plants and providing both nest and overwintering sites, to reduce the use of pesticides. So we're going to create and adopt an integrated pest management plan and hopefully reduce the overall pesticide use on campus. We're also committed to offering courses or continuing education opportunities that incorporate conservation of pollinators. And there are several other commitments that are part of this initiative of the B Campus USA, becoming a B Campus member.
Amy, when I think of bees, I think I'm like a lot of people. I picture the honeybee, but we have a lot more going on in Wisconsin in our native bee population. Can you introduce us to a state bee or two that might be helped by a project like this?
Yes, I'm not sure if I can still hear you. You cut off there. But yes, we have about 400 species of native bees in Wisconsin. They range from little tiny bees of pale colors, the Perdida, to large bees like our bumblebees. So yes, our most well-known bees are the honeybees and our bumblebees. So some of my favorite bees, one of my favorite bees or bee groups is the Osmia. So these bees are really pretty. They have metallic color. They're really round and cute looking. But we have bees that are metallic green. They're like race car green. We have others that are red. They have with yellow zebra stripes. So we have a really large diversity worldwide. There are about 20,000 bee species in the United States, about 3,600. And as I mentioned, in Wisconsin, we have around 400 species of bees that have been documented.
You mentioned, Amy, that students would be involved in the project. What kind of things will they do as part of the Bee Campus project?
Well, we have students on the committee. So we established a committee and met for the first time last week. So again, a really new initiative here. But students are going to be involved in maintaining our natural areas, enhancing native plant diversity. So we have students that work with our Cochrane Center for Biodiversity over the summer. And some of the things they're going to do this summer are in addition to controlling invasive species that reduce the overall plant resource diversity, they're going to enhance diversity in some of our prairie plantings and our oak savannas. In particular, they're going to increase the number of asclepias or milkweed species. Those are great species, as you know, for monarchs that use them as host plants, but they also provide nectar and pollen resources for a number of other pollinators, including our native bees. And in fact, even tomorrow, my ecology lab is going to be lending a hand tomorrow afternoon by managing garlic, mustard, and buckthorn in one of our woodland areas. This is an area that in the past has had really great spring ephemeral plants, which are so important for pollinators that are just coming out now. If you've been outside in the woodlands, you're seeing things like spring beauty and trout lily and Dutchman's breeches flowering. And those are really important resources for our native bees. When the bees emerge in the spring, they're looking for resources. And of course, some of these early spring flowers, or what we call spring ephemerals, are super important, as are things like willows, like pussy willow, are important resources of pollen and nectar for these bees that are setting up their nests.
In our last minute or so, Amy, I know the goal of the Bee City project is to inspire people to do things, maybe even in their own backyards, to help bees. What kind of things, simple things, might people who have a little bit of lawn space do to help these native bees of Wisconsin?
Yeah, so one of the main things that people can do in their own yards is grow native plants. Wild bees rely on these resources. They need resources that are staggered over the course of their flight season. So to be sure to include seasonal diversity, a variety of plants, different bees like different types of plants, and some use plants for a nectar resource and different ones for pollen. So again, high diversity native plants, provide both nesting and overwintering habitat. This could just be leaving bare patches in your lawn, maybe some rodent burrows that they don't fill. Bumblebees like, some species of bumblebees like to use those. And then, of course, avoid using pesticide as much as possible. And then encourage your friends, your neighbors, and family to do the same.
Amy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very happy to be here.
That's Amy Wolf, professor of natural and applied sciences at UW Green Bay. She talked with us about the school gaining the Bee City USA designation for its work creating habitats for pollinators. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum sharing a story about the time Wisconsin hosted a mini Woodstock.
Wisconsin Life is celebrating its 10th anniversary on WPR this year. One way we're commemorating this milestone is by asking producers to share their favorite stories. I reached out to Kirill Owen, a former technical director at WPR, about what her favorite story was. And this was the first piece that came to her mind. 51 years ago this month, long-haired hippies and flower children from across the Midwest converged on a small Wisconsin farm for a weekend of peace, love, and music. The Soundstorm Music Festival's lineup was stacked with mostly regional artists, but also included the Grateful Dead, who played a five-hour set. Historian Michael Edmonds tells the story.
It was April 1970 in Poinette, Wisconsin, of all places, just a few months after Woodstock. People wondered whether Woodstock could be replicated other places. So there was a little momentum to see what could be done. There was a local promoter of youth events who had the initial idea, but that was before Pete Bobo showed up. Pete was a biker who had been living on the West Coast. He met the Grateful Dead in San Francisco and stayed for a while on Ken Kesey's farm. And he lived to make a little money, ride his bike, have a good time. And he envisioned doing that for tens of thousands of people at once. Dead Dead were not famous. They were still relatively young. They were in their late 20s or around 30 years old. And they were still San Francisco's favorite house band. They were not a national sensation yet. Local officials in Poinette did everything in their power to stop it. You had a wonderful, almost idyllic, law-abiding small town. Several hundred people, where literally the churches outnumbered the taverns, and they were terrified of being outnumbered 20-1 by beatniks and hippies and bikers. And as one of the selectmen said, we didn't know, but they'd smash the windows and burn the whole town down. Hey, Saturday night. Yeah. That game garnered some press, and a grandmother up in Poinette, who had a big sprawling farm and didn't get along real well with her neighbors, said, why don't you come up here and see if you can have it up here? That farm, the farm of Irene York, turned out to be a perfect place for a festival, and she agreed to let them lease it for $5,000. As her son said in an interview, Mother didn't care what the people of Poinette thought, and she told them so. Sugar magnolia, blossoms blooming, heads all empty, I don't care. Tens of thousands of people streamed in and out of the York farm over the course of that weekend. The weather was gorgeous, around 80 and sunny. There was a little creek behind the stage, and people swam naked in the creek, played in the mud. There was always the fragrance of marijuana smoke in the air the whole weekend. There were no fights. There were no injuries. Almost everyone I spoke to who went said that they remembered it vividly and it changed their lives somehow. It proved to them that it was possible for 30,000 strangers to get along peacefully, ecstatically even, for several days and have 3 days of peace, love, and music.
Was historian Michael Edmonds talking about Soundstorm Music Festival, which took place in April 1970 in Poinette, Wisconsin. Former WPR technical director Kirill Owen mixed that story and wanted to share it as part of Wisconsin Life's 10th anniversary. She says she loves the fact that the Dead's obsessive documentarians have yet to find the audio from this show. Kirill hopes that someone finds a reel-to-reel in a box someday. She also just loves the story and Grandma York and has been a Dead fan since high school when she first saw them in February 1971. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell & Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll talk about the economics of the paper industry and tax incentives after Kimberly Clark announced plans to move hundreds of jobs out of the state. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Paper products manufacturer Kimberly Clark says it'll move more than 250 jobs out of the Fox Valley to Chicago. The company says the positions are in sales, marketing, and executive management. The move comes just over 2 years after the company said it would keep jobs in the state in exchange for tax breaks. Megan Hart is a reporter for WPR based in Green Bay who's been following the story. Megan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Steve Deller is a regional economist with UW-Madison. Steve, thanks for joining us again.
Good afternoon.
Megan, give us the basics. What do we know about these jobs that are going to be moving here?
Sure. So Kimberly Clark says that they will be moving about 250 jobs, mostly from the Fox Valley to the Chicago area. They're not going to be manufacturing jobs. And it's going to happen over the course of the next year or so. The company says that they will continue to have more than 2,500 employees in Wisconsin, and they will turn their Fox Valley facility into their North American Innovation, Technology, and Supply Center.
And as I mentioned, Megan, the state had a tax incentive deal to keep jobs in the state from a couple years back. As you just mentioned, many jobs will still be in the state. What are people looking at when it comes to that deal and whether this infringes on it at all?
Kimberly Clark says that they will continue to comply with that agreement, which was settled on with the Walker administration in late 2018. The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation says that they're going to look over the agreement just to make sure that it is still valid with these jobs moving. But in the original agreement, what was decided upon was that Kimberly Clark would need to keep about 400 technical manufacturing jobs in Wisconsin, in addition to investing in Wisconsin goods and services. They need to maintain an annual payroll of about $30 million in Wisconsin and then invest about $200 million in that NINA facility to ultimately earn up to $28 million in tax incentives over 5 years.
Now, Steve, this is a story about a manufacturing company moving jobs, but not manufacturing jobs. How common is this where we see big companies relocating these kind of, I think, more white-collar jobs, people consider them, the sales, marketing, things like that?
A lot of times it does make a lot of sense to kind of separate out the operations, particularly when you're talking about a company the size of a Kimberly Clark. I mean, they're an international company, so they're kind of looking at this from a very large perspective. So this kind of a move actually can make sense to the company's perspective.
Now, I think economic incentives for companies are on a lot of people's minds because of something that happened today, an announcement of a revised deal with Foxconn. We're going to talk about that on the show tomorrow. But Steve, as you look at this, you know, this deal reached in 2018 between the state and Kimberly Clark. Now, some of these jobs, a percentage of the jobs moving out of the state. Does that what do you think of that deal? And now as we're seeing some of those jobs go?
I think that Megan is right, is that the Walker tax incentive for Kimberly Clark was really aimed at the manufacturing site. And if I recall correctly, the kind of the business side of the company really wasn't part of the conversation. So this picking up and moving down to Chicago, it's almost like two separate, it's the same company, but it's two separate entities within the same company.
Now, Megan, looking at the people affected here, what are their options when it comes to relocating or not staying with the company, I guess?
Kimberly Clark says that it will relocate people whose jobs are moving to Chicago. They won't necessarily lose those jobs. The company says that by moving those positions to Chicago, they'll be a bit closer to a lot of their retail partners and the marketing and sort of digital agencies that they work with. And they actually, now Kimberly Clark, according to the city of Chicago, will qualify for tax incentives there as well with the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity. But based on a news release that came out last week, they hadn't yet sort of agreed on a deal yet.
And Steve, Megan just actually kind of raised my next question there. What one state giveth, another state can giveth later. Do we see a lot of cross-border competition between states like Wisconsin and Illinois using these kinds of incentives?
It is the modern war between the states. And Kimberly-Clark is not making this decision based on the incentives that Wisconsin is offering or Illinois-Chicago is offering. Kimberly-Clark has much bigger issues to worry about. And these incentives are basically almost free giveaways. So if Kimberly-Clark is going to, you know, is thinking about moving to Chicago, they're going to move to Chicago. And if Illinois wants to throw some money at them in terms of an incentive, Kimberly-Clark is going to say, yeah, sure, we'll take them. So in that regard, I don't think these incentives are making any difference whatsoever.
I know there are lots of different kinds and scales of incentives, Steve. I mean, are there times when an incentive is big enough that it does, in fact, make the decision or at least puts a lot of weight on the scale for a company to pick place A over place B?
Then we're back to kind of the Foxconn type discussion. And the research is pretty clear. The incentives that have to be big enough to actually influence the decision are so big that it's never a win-win. It's a win for the company. It's never a win for the state or the local government that's offering the incentives. They just don't work. Now, in the case of Kimberly-Clark, though, I mean, the Chicago here, Chicago has a specific neighborhood that they're focusing on. And they're really trying to get companies to come to Chicago and think specifically about this neighborhood. Now, in that regard, then they may have an influence. So if I locate on one side of, say, the loop, and I don't get the incentive, and I locate on the other side that the city's trying to promote, you know, then it might come into the decision. But the decision to pick up and move from Wisconsin to Illinois, the incentives don't matter.
Megan, in your reporting on this, you talked to some experts on state tax incentives who are really making the case that states should measure how different kinds of incentives work. What kind of things did you hear?
Sure. I spoke to the Pew Trust, who actually helps states kind of set up plans to evaluate their tax incentive programs, because they said for a long time politicians were making these decisions without a lot of insight into whether or not they were having a real economic impact. And Pew does rank Wisconsin as making progress in terms of how it sort of retroactively looks back at the incentive deals that it makes and evaluates them.
Now, Steve, 250 jobs. Oh, go ahead, Steve.
I think that's a very important point. The Foxconn deal, I think it was bad public policy, but the way the state put it together in terms of those clawbacks, I think that that was a very good strategic strategy. And it is, if the state's going to do something like this, they need to put those kind of safeguards in place. And we did do that with Foxconn, so the state got that part right.
And Steve, as we wrap up, 250 jobs, obviously there have been much bigger layoffs and closures and moves in the past, but it's not nothing. It's important to the people feeling it. For a community like the Fox Valley area, how big an impact in today's economy is this?
It doesn't really help. It's the types of jobs. These tend to be good paying jobs. But I don't think we're going to lose all those people. A lot of times companies move headquarters like this because what they're trying to do is they're trying to clear out middle and lower management, because they know when they make this move, some people are not going to go with them. So this is, can be a strategy to kind of say, okay, we need to reshuffle how this particular unit of the company is structured. And a good way to do that, we're going to pick up and move. And then it's up to the employees to make the decision to move or not. So while it's kind of a loss of jobs for the Fox Valley area, I think a lot of these folks are going to remain in the area and look for employment opportunities in other companies.
We'll leave it there. Steve, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
And Megan, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Megan Hart, WPR reporter based in Green Bay. She's been following the Kimberly-Clark job relocations. And Steve Deller was with us, regional economist with UW-Madison, frequent guest on these issues here on Central Time. By the way, tune in tomorrow on Central Time. We'll go from Fox Valley to Foxconn and look at tax incentives here in the state. The Evers administration says it's reached a new deal with the technology giant Foxconn. More on that story tomorrow after 4 here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, many parts of Wisconsin have trouble accessing high-speed internet. Find out about a new project that aims to solve that problem with drones. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then new research shows the number of suicides in the U.S. went down in 2020, contrary to some people's expectations. We'll look at why that might be and the wider issue of what the pandemic has meant for mental health. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.